Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, madam and messieurs, mes enfants, welcome to another edition of Night Talk Live with Paul at Night. Following information is presented for entertainment and information purposes only. Although Night Talk Radio takes all precautions to bring you quality information, Night Talk Radio is merely the purveyor of information, and you, the audience, shall be the judge of such information. We remind you, KVN MTOR, live from the broadcast bunker deep under the frozen tundra of the Canadian Rockies, your host, Colin Knight.
Good evening, everyone. Glad you could make it tonight live on a Thursday evening. For those listening to the download later, thank you for checking out the show. Tonight on Night Talk, we examine recent events involving the sun and tantalizing results of long-range detection of other planets.
Solar flares and the universe with Dr. Ian O'Neill, solar physicist. Next.
It is a real problem, and there's quite a few of us. Some of us are privileged to have been briefed on some of it. It's been well covered up by all of our governments for the last 6 years or so, but slowly it's leaked out.
347-324-3287, 347-324-3287, and we remind our listeners of the archived shows. Come to the blog, nighttalkradio.blogspot.com, and access 3 years worth of archived shows, only on nighttalkradio.blogspot.com. 347-324-3287, 347-324-3287. To contact the show by email, terrachat2012@gmail.com. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
And indeed, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madame and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of Night Talk Radio. For those of you listening live, remember, if you're signed into the blogtalkradio.com website, you can always come down to the Terror Chat show page, and you can participate in the virtual studio, interacting with other listeners while listening to the show. Just hit chat on the Terror Chat main show page, and you will be in the virtual studio in direct contact with me and those who are listening around the world. If you listen to the show at a later time, please take a moment to give a show a listener rating or leave a comment on the blog. Tonight, our good friend is back with us, Dr. Ian O'Neill, a solar physicist, author, and a plethora of other hats, which we shall chat about in a little while. And good evening, Ian, if I can get you up on this new, there we go, on this newfangled website they've got going there. Ian, how are you doing tonight?
Hi there, Colin. Everything's fine here. Thanks for inviting me back.
Oh, no, thank you for coming back. I hope Deborah is well and all's well in your world. AstroEngine, that's a pretty busy site that you've got going there, Ian.
Yeah, not quite as busy as I would hope, though, because I'm keeping fairly busy over at Discovery News with my space producing. So most of my action at the moment is going on over on discoverynews.com. But AstroEngine's still going well, still going strong. I just need to update it a little bit more regularly.
Yeah, well, it's difficult. I mean, we run a couple of those blog sites, and it's hard keeping up to all of the maintenance that's required and the postings and the corrections and what have you. So I can relate to that. Ian, over the last 6 months, we've been inundated with the theory and fiction fact, as I call it, about what is happening recently with the sun and the solar flares. Can you enlighten us if this is an anomaly or has this been predicted for some time?
Yeah, this is all fairly normal. And it's kind of a welcome relief because up and, well, from about 2006 all the way through to 2009, the summer was very, very quiet. And although that was kind of expected, that was a very, very long quiet period. That was the solar minimum. And it was a very deep minimum. It was a period of time where the sun was, for some reason, it just went to sleep. Magnetically, it was very, very quiet. Right. Now it's kind of picking up in activity, and this is to be expected as well, although some of the things we're seeing is unexpected, but that's probably due to our advanced observatories we've now got orbiting the Earth to view the sun. But this is to be expected because the sun is gradually winding up now towards solar maximum, and it's expected to reach solar maximum in around about 2013. Toward the end of 2012, 2013, you will start seeing a lot more solar flares, and then it will go into another quiet period. It's all just part of the natural 11-year cycle of the sun.
Right. Now, the way I'm seeing it is everything seems to be coming into focus for this 2012 galactic alignment and the likes. Is it possible that it's all interplaying, or is the sun just doing what the sun does?
Well, you know my views on the whole 2012 doomsday theories and the alignments and everything. And this is it's a coincidence in that the sun is going to be reaching solar maximum towards the end of 2012. But really, 2013 is going to be the year before solar maximum. That's pretty much what we know for sure. We're going to see an increase in activity. As recently, in the last few months, the sun has been treating it to some magnificent displays. I mean, most recently, for me personally, the most incredible display was on June 8th, I believe, in the early hours of the morning. And the sun unleashed a very unusual flare. It exploded on the solar surface, emitted a coronal mass ejection, this big bubble of gas fired out into space. But what we saw, what the leftovers, was this almost a fountain of dark material that kind of fell back down onto the solar surface. And NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory was there to capture that event and actually saw, in very high definition, saw this cloud of very dark material. And the reason why it was dark is because it was cooler than the solar surface. So it was kind of cool material, and it kind of rained down back on the solar surface. So we're kind of given this ringside seat now because we've got some very, very advanced observatory missions in space, and of course we've got observatories down here on the ground, and we're able to see amazing details. Some of these things we've never seen before, and that's purely because we haven't been able to see them. It's not so the sun is doing anything new. It's just that we've been given these new high definition eyes, especially using the Solar Dynamics Observatory. It's incredible.
Yeah, and we are seeing further into space than we've ever done before, to the point that we are now coming to terms with the possibility that we are not alone. We're slowly coming to terms with it. There's been a couple of planets out there that have shown some magnificent possibilities.
Yeah, and of course the Kepler Space Telescope that's been observing the sky now for well over a year is actually found a catalogue of over 1,200 candidate exoplanets now. So that's worlds orbiting other stars. And to find that many, I mean, there's been around about 500 that have been confirmed before Kepler, but now Kepler is finding smaller and smaller worlds. And they're actually candidate planets that could be around about Earth mass, around about Earth size, and they could be orbiting their stars within the habitable zone. So that's the perfect distance from their parent star that allows liquid water to exist on the surface. Right. Of course, we can't see the surface of these exoplanets. We have no idea if there's any life on them. We have no idea if there's life on Mars. I mean, that's in our galactic backyard. But we are getting some very lovely signs that there are other worlds very much like Earth, not dissimilar to Earth, and there's other systems not dislike our solar system. So we're by no means unique. So you've got our missions such as SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, looking out for these these radio beacons from aliens. And of course, with Kepler's help, SETI is able to focus on a few of these stars. But SETI, they're going through a few funding issues at the moment, which I'm sure we can probably discuss later. But yeah, interesting times. Very good time to be a space producer.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. I think the interest, as you say, interesting times. Every faction of society is feeling the economic pressures, and NASA and the other space organizations are no different. They are they're under the budget knife in incredible ways, because it's a huge debt that the United States are trying to get under control, that the world is trying to get under control. So I can see them cutting and slashing at scientific opportunities, unfortunately. But there are a couple of private companies that are trying to get up there into the stars, and that's definitely showing some interest. I was quite surprised at how many private corporations are actually meddling, if you will, into space travel and long-distance journey.
Absolutely, yeah. And even on my backyard in Los Angeles in Hawthorne, we've got the headquarters of SpaceX, the Elon Musk venture. He was the founder of PayPal, and he invested his billions into founding his own rocket company. And he's beginning to show the world that private corporations can build these rockets from the ground up purely for commercial interests. So he has a very small outfit. He's able to launch things on the cheap. He's already proved this. Of course, there's been a bumpy road up until now. You haven't done anything magical here. A few rockets have exploded. But now he's getting very good at launching stuff into space. And it's a very good private sector infrastructure that's building up now. And it's exciting because we're actually beginning to see the foundations for an in-space infrastructure. So we're basically getting these almost SpaceX could be considered like a taxi firm or a cargo hauler, in that they are going to be paid by agencies such as NASA to just get stuff into low Earth orbit. So we'll start to see SpaceX launching supplies, automated spaceships with supplies on board to the International right. Space Station, and at a later date, hopefully launching astronauts to the space station, and it's all for profit. These are viable companies, yeah. And it's not just SpaceX. There's a handful of other companies that are all competing for these. First of all, they're going to be NASA contracts, and of course, you've got private satellite companies that want other private enterprises to put their satellites into orbit. So it's again very, very exciting. But as you mentioned before, the economy is a big problem at the moment, especially for large entities like NASA, government-funded agencies. They're really feeling the pinch at the moment. So perhaps commercial space will start reinvigorating the sector, and perhaps we'll see more science yes. coming out of it.
Well, most certainly, the innovation is with the private sector. That's been proven time and time again. That's the idea of the patent system. There is no system that becomes legally capable of being licensed and registered unless the military or the government have not had a look at it first. So, you know, the best inventions come from the private sector. There's no doubt about that. But what do you think of I was very surprised, Ian, that there was very little coverage of the European garbage freighter, if you will, coming back to Earth. There was a couple of byline stories, but nobody really paid much attention to that story. And yet, this was a technological marvel.
True, yeah. And I think the ATV, the Automated Transfer Vehicle, that's, of course, manufactured by the European Space Agency, it received less coverage over here, but I know in the UK it was kind of headline news. And I suppose because this is the second one that's done it. So the first time it was all new, the automated transfer vehicle, everybody was watching it again, launching to space. They're doing its automated part in because it's got some really advanced robotics on board. I mean, the system on it was second to none. And it was able to hone in on its target, follow the space station, dock automatically, do this mission, and then you're dropped back through the atmosphere with a load of garbage, so it gets destroyed over the Pacific Ocean. So the first time, I think it really captivated people's imaginations. This time, we're like, well, you know, we've done it once before, we'll do it again. But I find it terrific. I mean, I find the partnerships with the International Space Station and all the countries that are supplying it, I find that fascinating. Because also the Japanese have got this an automated transfer vehicle as well, and so have the Russians. Just different designs, different initiatives, but ultimately fulfilling the same goal. They just got their own different flair on it. And that's why I like the International Space Station. Now, unfortunately, now we're losing the shuttle, of course. Next month is curtains for the shuttle program. Once Atlantis launches, I think it's scheduled for the 8th of July. Once that's over, yeah, I don't know. It's a bit of a grey future, to be honest, because the shuttle really is the biggest vehicle, the biggest launch vehicle we have to launch and assemble stuff in space. So, of course, we're going to lose that capability, and it's a bit of a backward step, in my view.
Well, I found it interesting that they used the ATV, the garbage shuttle, as I call it. They used the garbage shuttle to push the space station to a very high orbit, something that they haven't achieved as of yet. And until now, and they've moved it fairly high up in the orbit system. So it's going to be, you know, a wee more miles to get to than it was the last time we went up, you know. So I'm just wondering if private enterprise will be the ones that will service it, and how long has the space station got? I mean, it's been constantly built for the last 20 years, but what is it capable of doing in comparison to today's technology? Is the technology up to date, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, up until only recently, the funding for the International Space Station only ran as far as 2015. So it was going to be scrapped in 4 years' time. Of course, that's just stupid. So obviously there's going to be an extension, and it's probably going to go until at least 2020, so we've got another 9 years of it doing science. But also there's some amazing instruments on there. I mean, very recently they put up forget the name of it now, but it's a particle detector. It costs like $2 billion to build, but it can do basically what the Large Hadron Collider can do in detect these high-energy particles coming from space. And it can actually stand there. As long as on the International Space Station, it's going to keep on detecting these particles. Hopefully it will find some evidence for why there isn't more antimatter in the universe, what is dark matter. All these big questions that we're spending a lot of time trying to understand with our universe. This instrument on the International Space Station is doing some fantastic science. And I can't imagine an early close on the International Space Station when you have experiments like that in space. And to be honest, I think that it can last for a long time. It's certainly got a good shelf life, and I can see it lasting beyond 2020, especially when you've got a big collaboration of nations all pooling funds together. And also there's alternative visions for the International Space Station. There's a lot of commercial interest in sending experiments into space, so like the pharmaceutical companies. All these different sectors of our civilization are suddenly very interested in microgravity experiments. So there is more time, more emphasis being spent on perhaps these commercial impetus to use a space station. So it's going to be around for a while yet. But also, as you were saying about the boost that the ATV gave the International Space Station to promote its orbit. Of course, that's a constant battle for the International Space Station, because even at those kind of altitudes, over 200 miles high, or something around that amount, there's very thin atmosphere up there. And so it causes a drag on the International Space Station. So over time, it will slowly slow down and drop to lower orbit. So it needs that boost from any spaceship that's attached to the space station at the time. So the Russian Soyuz and Progress vehicles, I believe they also give the space station a boost as well. But the ATV, that was one of its big design criteria, was to promote the International Space Station's orbit. So it's good that they've got that capability.
The only thing that scares me now is that if Vinny's garbage collection out of New York City get the idea to launch waste up into space and allow it to rain back down into the atmosphere and burn up, you know, we could have a very messy planet. It would seem like a perfect way to get rid of garbage, though, wouldn't it? You know, the amount of garbage you create on a weekly basis.
Yeah, but I'd argue that if you can get it into low Earth orbit, I'd say, you know, try and launch it toward the sun. At least when it's completely out of our hands, and the sun can deal with it. But I think the launch costs are prohibitively large in that case.
Yeah, for the volume that you could get rid of, probably you're right. Yeah, probably the volume would have to be so massive, wouldn't it, to make it financially feasible. But we got to learn to do something with it, Ian. I mean, we can't keep building on top of it. Sooner or later, it's, you know.
Yeah, and of course, with Kuala, our nation's really struggling with it. Athens, I think, was under a load of trash, wasn't it, recently? And they had to send the army in to clear it out. And problems in Italy as well. There was all sorts of strange things going on in these cities.
Well, I think we've become too successful. I think that's where the problem has kind of hit, is that our society, we now live to three times the expected age of 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and chances are we're going to live a lot longer than that in the next generations. So,
and it's pretty I was just going to say, it's pretty scary because we're actually using future resources now. And I read a report recently that apparently we're using 1.5 Earths of resources. So basically now we're eating into our future, which is unsustainable at best. You always hear about, you know, green technologies. You always hear about sustainable living. Unfortunately, we're not really having that kind of sustainable impact. And I don't think we will do until we run out of resources. Then we have to live sustainably. So we're very slow at acting, unfortunately.
Yeah. With the space station, Ian, how do they avoid being hit by these various radiation bursts and solar gamma bursts and the likes? What is their shielding? Is it basic or is it an advanced style of shielding?
Well, there are safe areas on the space station. I'm not entirely sure what they're made of, but I think there's a couple of compartments that are pretty well shielded. I'm not absolutely certain about how they shield them. But on a day-to-day living on the space station, radiation is just a fact of life. You are going to get a higher than normal dose of radiation. So that is a constant threat to astronauts who spend a long period of time in space. But as yet, I don't think there's been any studies that have suggested that astronauts are prone to, you know, a lot of more cases of cancer or radiation-related
sickness.
I'm not entirely sure if there's been too many studies on it, but as far as I can tell, they are still, you know, healthy, functioning people when they're, even if they spent a long time in space. But it is just a hazard, and often you hear about stories of the early astronauts, the early Apollo astronauts, when they went to the moon. There was a classic interview, I believe, with Buzz Aldrin, and he was saying that when you see these sparks, you see these flashes in your eyes, and apparently that's high-energy particles hitting your retina. And so you're very aware of this high energy environment that you're in. As soon as you leave the Earth's atmosphere, to be honest, you know, you're at the mercy of the sun and high energy particles from deep space. There's not really a lot you can do about it.
Right. And we talked about this the last time you were on, but we never quite got deep into it. But heading to Mars, it's an 18-month journey for the equipment that we have today. And the return of some manned force to Mars is questionable. So where do you think we're going to go with that? Is there an energy that can be used in space that we're not using right now?
Well, at the moment, there's a lot of talk about advanced propulsion techniques. And interestingly, it's a little bit out there, but I've I'm in contact with the guys that run Project Icarus, and basically they're looking into a project to get to another star. So this is a little bit bigger scope than just getting to Mars. These guys are actually thinking about traversing interstellar space in a certain amount of time that would allow a human being to experience it. So basically they want to be able to do it in a human lifetime. And of course, to get to the nearest star, you need to go really fast to actually make that possible. So you need some very advanced form of propulsion to do this, because you need to reach something like 2 or 3% of the speed of light to actually make it to the nearest star, which is Proxima Centauri, and it'll probably take 50 to 80 years to get there if you can go an appreciable amount of speed of light. Otherwise, you're talking 100,000 years to get there using current propulsion techniques. So I was chatting actually to Richard Abusi, the founder of Project Icarus, and he was saying that perhaps, and in fact, he's totally going to be going to the Mars Society convention in Dallas, Texas, in early August. I'm actually speaking about it as well. And hopefully he's going to share his ideas for advanced propulsion techniques to just get to Mars. So it should be exciting.
Yeah, because it would seem to me that we have to come up, you know, thank God it's not oil we're using to get them there, because we seem to use oil for everything else, you know. So I'm impressed that we've managed to step away from that quagmire. But the propulsions we're using are very rudimentary, really, to break Earth's orbit. But we have not really looked at the propulsion other than to the moon, as far as any long distance is concerned, and of course guidance systems. So, are all of these being kind of tested up at the space lab? Are there some experiments that are doing that?
Yeah, there's a lot of initiatives going on. Of course, there's a lot of space missions at the moment that are using ion drives, and unfortunately, the speeds that they get to, you know, are quite pedestrian. Over a long period of time, ion drives, you can go really fast. But of course, when you're talking about just pumping out a few atoms at the back of your spaceship, you know, you're not going to get anywhere very fast. So you certainly can't lift off of a planetary surface using an ion drive. In deep space, they're fantastic, but you need time to actually build up momentum and build up speed to actually get anywhere. So you'll find there's a lot of missions that are now using ion drives, but they also have very long time periods to complete their missions. Of course, with human beings in space, as we just discussed with the whole radiation issue, you don't want to be spending too much time in deep space, or you need a very, very good way of shielding against radiation. And so really the next big step for humans in space is really going to be Obama's plan, President Obama's plan. He set NASA only a few months ago, basically to, over a year ago now, to send humans to an asteroid. And so NASA is currently looking at possible targets to get a team of astronauts in a spaceship and send them to an asteroid to check it out and come back. So it's going to be like a test to do it. And they're going to look at different propulsion techniques. At the moment, that is just using conventional techniques that we use at the moment, just, you know, your rocket boosters to get into space and then rocket boosters in space to get to your target. And I think it's going to be some time before we start really experimenting with advanced propulsion techniques, especially things as extreme as like nuclear pulse propulsion, because at the moment you're not allowed to detonate anything nuclear in space. That's going to be a little bit further down the line if that does happen. And there's, you know, all the science fiction ideas that are out there, and there's a few serious, there's some serious research going into even warp drives. So nothing is off the table. Let's put it that way, because we need to find easier ways to get around the space. But it all comes down to energy, and it all comes down to what technology is available to us now. So it's going to take some time, but there's certainly inspiring stuff when you read some of these research projects that are being done right now. And who knows, eventually some one idea may stick, and it may be feasible to be able to do it within our lifetime. So we could be looking at very short treks to Mars, rather than the 18 months, as you said, to spend in space to actually send a manned team to Mars. Even a few months would be will be hard, wouldn't it be nice to get there in a few weeks or a couple of weeks or days? So
right.
we're just got to see. Space is a very big place, and I don't think people, I don't fully appreciate how big space is, but when you start talking about taking 100,000 years to get to the nearest star using current propulsion techniques, I'd say that's a bit of a bummer. You know, I'm not very happy about that.
Yeah.
So we need to find ways of bridging that gap. If it does happen at all, I mean, who knows? We may run out of time. We may use up all our resources. And my main concern is there's a lot of pressures on spacefaring nations. There's a lot of pressure on the likes of NASA. Are they going to have the money to be able to do this? Are they actually going to have the physical resources in the near future to be able to put together these high-tech rockets and high-tech missions to go into deep space and to create a sustainable economy in space if we run our resources down here first? So I'd say get the space infrastructure up and running now before it's too late, because there's a lot of resources in space we could use, and we haven't even put our foot in the pond yet. We're just floating around in near Earth orbit, and really that's it. We sent a few robots further out, but unfortunately for mankind, are we going to be stuck on the planet, or are we going to go further away? I just hope eventually we're going to push further into space.
And I think you're right. With that, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll get back into some of this mess this sun is starting to give us.
You're listening to Night Talk Radio on the Terror Chat Radio Network.
There's a monolith there, a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? God put it there.
Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mavis, with John Holt in the night.
According to Genesis, Eden, or Eden, is where Adam was created from dust and Eve from one of his ribs. Others, however, have a more high-tech version of how human life began.
It is a real problem, and there's quite a few of us, and some of us are privileged to have been briefed on some of it. It's been well covered up by all of our governments for the last 6 years or so, but slowly it's leaked out.
347-324-3287, 347-324-3287, and we remind our listeners of the archived shows, 3 years of fabulous interviews of some amazing guests. Come to the blog, nighttalkradio.blogspot.com, on nighttalkradio.blogspot.com. 347-324-3287, 347-324-3287, things that go bump in the night. To contact the show by email, terrorchat2012@gmail.com. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
And Ian, as we've been chatting here, I've been receiving a couple of tweets, and one of the tweets was, how come every time when you come out of a commercial, they call it a commercial, she's from England, that you play I've Got a Ticket to the Moon? And that's kind of my little signal to Ian, because that was the first intro that I used on Ian O'Neill when he came onto our original show. So it's kind of just a little favorite I have. It means nothing to anybody else but me, but I kind of enjoy it. So, Ian, with these farts and blips and what have you of the sun, can we expect to see more dancing and activity in the future? And if so, is that going to interfere with our satellites and communication devices, do you think?
Oh, yeah. We can expect a lot of fireworks in the not-too-distant future. As I say, in the run-up to solar maximum, which happens when the sun is at its most stressed, after over a course of 11 years, the sun gradually winds up and up and up in magnetic strength, if you like. It's almost like a coil that's gradually being wound up tighter and tighter and tighter over a course of 11 years. And what happens when you wind up an elastic band so tight, it eventually buckles and snaps. And what happens with the sun, when it buffers and snaps, it produces a lot of fantastic coronal loops. It produces a lot of magnetic activity across the surface of the sun. And when you get a lot of magnetic activity, you get a lot of forcing. So when you have all these magnetic field lines crossing, they end up snapping. And when this happens, it can be the correct environment to create a flare and coronal mass ejections. Now, you've probably seen flares as these amazing explosive events on the surface of the sun. And you'll see like photographs from NASA, from the Solar Dynamics Observatory and the Solar Heliospheric Observatory that's in space, looking at the sun constantly. They'll take pictures of these flares. And these flares are so bright, they actually overwhelm the cameras on board, and you'll see a lot of bleed across the CCD pixels. And so they look very impressive. So they go off the scale, especially X-class solar flares. So the amount of energy that's released in that moment is incredible. So you see them as X-rays and other really hard radiation. That in itself is kind of dangerous to if you're in space, if you're outside of our protective atmosphere. But also, as a consequence of all this magnetic forcing, you can also get coronal mass ejections, which are it's very similar to solar flares. They're different creatures in a lot of ways, but they can be related. One can cause the other. And basically, that's right. When a similar thing happens. There is a big magnetic bubble of hot plasma that can erupt, and it can get ejected into space at speed, and it can hit us within a day or two. So it can race through space very, very quickly. And, of course, in this case, coronal mass ejections are generally more feared than solar flares, because coronal mass ejections actually hit us with high-energy particles. And, of course, when that happens, we get wonderful aurora. We get wonderful northern lights. You'll see them bouncing across the skies in high latitudes, which is one of the great side effects of solar storms and geomagnetic storms, when the magnetic field of the sun actually interacts with the Earth's magnetic field. But also, as you mentioned, that can have some very bad effects for technology, in that these high-energy particles can hit our satellites. They can basically hit the electronics on our satellites and cause all sorts of trouble on board. So they can knock out the computers, they can overload circuits. So we could have some satellites that just stop working. We could see them re-enter the atmosphere. We could have irretrievable data loss through, say if our GPS system got hit, maybe you know where they're going. Of course, you know, that's probably an overused example, especially in space circles, that, you know, what we do about a GPS, but actually it would be an issue, especially for airline pilots, for one. That's a particularly dangerous threat if we started losing satellites.
It would be an issue on every level of society, whether people realize it or not. The taxis in London run on GPS now. They don't dispatch without GPS. I mean, and they know that these things are very high tech systems, and you would be amazed how many people. FedEx, I believe, and Purolator are both GPSed, and they are.
Another big area of concern is if the coronal mass ejection is big enough, it can flood our upper atmosphere with high-energy particles. And when that happens, it generates a current through the atmosphere. And that, in turn, can induce a current through our national power grids. Now, this happened back in 1995 in Quebec, in Canada. They actually overloaded an entire national power grid, and that was during winter. So people were suddenly without power during, you know how bad winters can get in Canada. So that is a direct consequence of a solar storm hitting our everyday life in the most basic level. Can you imagine losing power if the national power grid gets burnt out? And unfortunately, they don't have backup systems for power grids, because there's nothing that can really take them out. Apart from a solar storm. And as we become more and more dependent on electronics, as we become more dependent on our power grids, more dependent on high-tech space technology, it's ultimately a big disaster waiting to happen, in my view. And a lot of scientists share the same. And this isn't like a doomsday scenario that's just been made up.
this has actually happened. There's been examples of these things happening. As we become more dependent on high technology, we're setting ourselves up for a big fall if we get hit by something very big from the sun. All indications are the sun's just going to continue as normal, or even it's going to go through actually a very quiet period in the future. There's other theories that it could actually explode to life in 10 years' time for no reason. I mean, our star is still a big mystery to us. We have a real hard job predicting what's going to happen next.
Right. Now, have we come up with any kind of earthbound shielding to protect our grids or our electronics? Is there anything on the horizon that gives us some kind of solace that we're not going to get technologically wiped out?
There are plans, and unfortunately, this is with a lot of space science is severely underfunded. And to be honest, this area of space science I would consider severely underfunded, because I actually did research in this field in space weather. Basically, whatever happens in the search of the sun can impact life on Earth. And there's several different chains along the way, but there's different ways that you can predict what's going to happen short term. So we're getting very good at looking at the surface of the sun. We already know the sun goes through 11-year cycles, so we can just about predict when the sun's going to become more active. We can't predict individual events, but we can predict the likelihood of a big solar flare or a big coronal mass ejection being flung in our direction. But there are a lot of systems in place using the current observatory we have in orbit and also ground-based observatories to actually measure the magnetic field on the surface of the sun, measuring the activity and active regions on the sun. And if there is a solar flare, we can't really do a lot about solar flare because, of course, when you see the flare happen, you've already been hit by the X-rays. So really, that's solar flares, they happen, it's just a risk, especially if you're in space and you're suddenly looking at the sun, which isn't wise. But in the case of coronal mass ejections, it depends on how fast they're coming at you. But when they are launched from the surface of the sun, we know generally which direction they're heading in. And so we can predict, and we know how fast they're traveling, so therefore we can predict when they're going to hit us. So in that case, especially with satellites, satellite companies could just choose to turn off their satellites, because if there's no current flowing in the circuitry, less errors can be forced by these high-energy particles hitting the circuitry. It's not to say they're going to be completely safe, but it can mitigate some of the problems. But unfortunately, the satellites are always going to be vulnerable, and you can't exactly launch them in space with lead-lined casing because that costs too much. You can't launch heavy satellites into space.
Yeah.
So really, smaller is the better in space, but that's a problem. But then, of course, you've got power grids on the ground, and really there isn't any protection for getting hit by a solar storm for these power grids because you're totally vulnerable. But the one thing you can do, power companies could literally just turn down the current of their power grids so they can reduce the amount of electricity flowing through their grid when you get hit by a solar flare, a coronal mass ejection. And in that case, you can, again, mitigate some of the worst that the sun can throw at you. But again, we don't really know what's going to happen when you get hit by something really big. I don't really think there is anything we can do.
Right. Now, can the sun be manipulated by other forces? For instance, there's a question down in the virtual studio. Is Elenine going to cause a CME later this year? Can the sun be influenced by a close encounter or by an impact from another asteroid or anything?
No.
Could that alter the timeline?
No, nothing that our solar system possesses. At the moment, you know, all our planets orbit the sun in very, very ordered orbits. The sun constantly gets hit by comets. We actually watch them hit the sun, but they have no effect. They burn up before they even come close to the surface of the sun. There's nothing sizable that could cause an issue. And there's loads of doomsday theories, especially about 2012, that what happens if the dreaded Planet X or Nibiru comes out of deep space and, you know, does a flyby of the sun? Could it trigger all these solar flares? And the short answer is no. For a start, there's no such thing. But for actually gravitationally causing that kind of impact on the sun, the sun is a very big ball of gas. And to be honest, that is the overwhelming force the energy that overwhelms everything else in the solar system. So unless I had an encounter with another star, so in which case we'd have to have a merging star system, if that happened, we'd be toast anyway, so we wouldn't be worrying about solar flares. So to be honest, there's no external factor that can influence the sun in a dramatic way. I dare say that there might be some interaction, perhaps when the sun travels around the galactic plane. There may be something out there that could influence how the sun interacts, but that's just clutching at straws. There isn't anything that we know of that can cause any kind of problem, especially gravitationally, because really the sun is it. I mean, that's the center of our solar system. It's going to stay like that until it dies in 2 billion years' time. So I think we're okay.
and what about this? I have to ask this question because it still confuses me, and I'm not by any means a scientist, but what about this binary star theory that there's another sun out there somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, actually, this is a quite interesting field of real research. I mean, once you wade through all the theories about Planet X and Nibiru and all these fanciful doomsday theories, especially on YouTube,
right,
there is actually some research that goes into seeing if there is a stellar partner for our sun. Now, we're not looking for another sun, another star like our sun. There's no way, because we would have seen it long before now. But there are some ideas that perhaps there could be a brown dwarf, which is actually they call it a failed star. It's basically halfway between a star and a planet. It's a very confused, very massive planet, if you like. So it can't quite sustain nuclear fusion in its core, so it can't be a star. But it also has convection within its atmosphere, which makes it almost act like a dead star. So it's this weird creature that's halfway between a massive planet and a very small star. Now, there are some ideas that perhaps there could be a stellar partner. There could be something like a brown dwarf orbiting a great distance. I mean, we're talking the kind of distances we kind of see, because brown dwarfs are still quite big. And also, we've got a lot of infrared observatories now. So in the case of the Wide Field Infrared Observatory that NASA's got going at the moment, WISE, basically it's actually doing a survey trying to find anything that will emit infrared radiation. Now, brown dwarfs, they emit a lot of infrared radiation because they're kind of warm, they're kind of toasty. So that would come up, that would actually appear in the data for these infrared observatories. So they are looking at data. I actually interviewed the head scientist at WISE, and he said, yeah, sure enough, we will look through the data. It's not as if this is pseudoscience here. There is some evidence to suggest that our star may have a stellar partner, because let's face it, most stars we look at in the night sky do have partners of some sort. They do belong to binary systems. So it's reasonable to think that perhaps our system may have a distant partner, but it's unlikely, to say the least. But there is some science that goes into it, and it's very interesting science. It's fascinating stuff.
So, is it possible the warmth from that brown dwarf, that twin, is that possible that that could be the reason for the warming of the planets out by Pluto and the likes? Could that be a reasoning
No. No, it's very weak. I mean, when we're talking infrared radiation, we're talking it's extremely weak radiation. It's almost cold. If you have a look in space, I mean, some of these brown dwarfs, they are actually colder than a cup of tea. So they're around about 100 degrees Celsius. So something of that size, and even if they were hotter, like 5 degrees, they're not going to cause any kind of heating. The observed warming, especially like of Pluto, there's other explanations for that, and they're easily, that's another fascinating field of study, but there's no external influence. It's just different oddities in orbits and spin and orbital configurations, basically. That's really where the planetary heating comes from. But a brown dwarf couldn't have that kind of effect.
So could this brown dwarf have been mistaken to be Nibiru or Planet X or the likes?
Yeah.
Could it have been mistaken,
Yeah, well, if we did find it, we'd say that that is Nemesis, because there's another field of study that says, you know, the sun's twin could be, they call it Nemesis. So if they did find it, I'm sure it would be called Nemesis immediately. But if we did see it, yeah, I mean, it could be confused for a large planetary body in the outer solar system. But we'll say there's no real evidence for it yet. It's just an aside. You wouldn't get research funding to solely look for this planetary body that would wrapped into some other big research project. So nobody's really taking it, you know, hugely seriously, because there's not really a lot of benefit from doing that kind of search, especially when there's not a lot of evidence suggesting this. But it is an interesting aside. You know, I've spoken to some scientists that are very dubious about its existence, very skeptical that it even exists. But other scientists are like, well, you know, it's certainly worth looking into. And there's some other evidence, like frequency of comets, comets passing through the inner solar system, but they say that perhaps there could be a large planetary body orbiting within the Oort cloud, which is very distant. That's the outermost reaches of our solar system, literally, like, I think it's like half a light year away. So we're talking very, very far away. There could be something orbiting within there, disturbing the orbits of comets. But really, that's the only suggestion that there could be something out there. Again,
right.
It's an unknown, but it's interesting.
Well, the distance that we are looking into space now compared to 30 years ago is remarkable. So, the next generation, I believe, are the ones that are going to find those answers that have plagued mankind since the beginning of time, I think. I think there's going to be revelation. I don't think it's going to be of a biblical portion, but I do believe that some of what is written, Mayan or otherwise, possibly have some ring of truth with a great deal of legend and fable.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's open to interpretation, especially with ancient texts. But we are going through a revolution, a technological revolution. I mean, the fact that we can command landers and rovers on the surface of Mars, a different planet, an alien world, the fact we can do that, I mean, I'm fascinated. I actually went to their NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena only last month to see the next Mars rover, to see the Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity. And it's a fantastic piece of equipment. And this thing is as big as a car. And the science is going to be doing it. I mean, just the description of how it's going to get to Mars, how they're going to launch it, how they're going to actually let it enter the Martian atmosphere. They've got this incredible system. It's called a sky crane that will basically be a rocket pack to land this massive car on the surface of the red planet. And there's so many intricate measures that are being done to make sure this happens. And I'm just going to be fascinated. When that thing lands, I'm going to be completely in love with another Mars mission. So the stuff we're doing is incredible. And again, the only thing we're kind of missing out on at the moment is the impetus to send humans into space to colonize.
Right.
There's a lot of debate as to why we need to do this when we can send robots in our place. I'd say it's part of the human experience to explore. I mean, America wouldn't have been discovered if it wasn't for the human ability to go beyond, to venture outside their comfort zone. In fact, you know, almost kill themselves to try and explore strange new worlds. And this is exactly what we should be doing in space. And unfortunately, in this day and age, we think the robot can do it for a lot cheaper. So, and it can, but I wouldn't say it does it as well, and I certainly wouldn't say we get the human experience that we should. And also, there's the classic Stephen Hawking argument that, why have we got all our eggs in one basket? We've only got one human race. We're all living on this one rock. If you get wiped out by the cosmos on a whim, we could get hit by a large asteroid in the next few decades. Who knows? Wouldn't it make sense to have pockets of human life throughout the solar system, if not beyond? You know, it's a debate.
We're definitely vulnerable. There's no doubt about it. We're vulnerable in the fact that we're all here in the same place, and mankind would not continue its existence if Earth collapsed or whatever happened. Yeah, I agree with you there. But here's a question coming out of our Facebook accounts. Now, I don't know how a solar physicist would have knowledge of this, Ian, but we're going to give it a crack. Do you think that either Russia or the United States or Japan have investigated sex in space?
The official line is no, but the unofficial line is possibly. And there's some rumors going around that the Russians may have investigated this. Also, there have been, this mixed sex situation on the International Space Station. There's rumors going around that it's been tried out. Unfortunately, there's no official line. But it's certainly not as romantic as a lot of people think. Let's put it that way.
Well, no, I don't think it's the romanticism they're looking for, but I think it would be, it makes the Mile High Club look like amateurs, doesn't it? Really, it's...
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, we don't have that lot of time to go for this, but I'm just curious, how would our reproductive organs work in space? What would we produce?
Yeah, we don't really know.
All of these questions, like a child is born in weightlessness and that comes back to Earth, how would they, there are so many situations we don't know about this neighborhood around our world. It continues to fascinate me, Ian.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about, eventually, if we did get to colonize Mars, there's a lot of questions. How would we function as a society? We're not only talking about eating, sleeping, doing research, doing science, but also cultural stuff. How would art be interpreted on Mars? Would there be a different culture than what we experience down here on Earth? And it's a fascinating area of study, and this is where I'm going to be talking at the Mars Society Convention in August. It's going to be discussing different ways and means of colonizing Mars. And it's not just about the nuts and bolts, actually getting there. It's about the human experience. How will humans adapt to a different world? It's a philosophical question as much as it's a scientific question. And I find that intriguing that we're actually asking these questions.
Yeah. And with that, it's just about at the end here. How can people get in touch with you, Ian? And you should throw out your website there for me.
Yeah, have a look on astroengine.com. There's all my contact details there, but you can always catch my writing over at discoverynews.com. So just type in discovery.com and have a look under space. You'll see articles from me. I every day I'm writing an article about some different part of space. Everything's happening in space at the moment where I can't possibly keep up. By the team of writers that also contribute to the site. And as a team, I think we pretty much cover all the best that can come out of space. So discovernews.com, find me there.
Fantastic. Ian, once again, it's an absolute pleasure. We burned through an hour like it was nothing again. And we're going to have to have you back. I got a million more questions for you.
Wonderful. I look forward to it. Thanks for having me on the show, Colin.
Thank you, Ian. You take care. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ian O'Neill. So a physicist who helps us out from time to time to try and understand the mess that's happening out there in the universe and to cut the chaff away and get down to the nitty-gritty of what is real and what is just folklore on the internet. But there we go. Another hour, another edition of Night Talk Radio. It has been a pleasure. Until the next time. Hey guys, got a minute? I'm sure we all have friends that are having tough times, either financially or in their marriage or in their general relationships in life. But for the grace of God, go I. Well, I have friends like that. As they look to me for advice, I look to the heavens for some form of divine inspiration so I can please the masses, I guess. And it doesn't always happen. So what I would like to say to you tonight is, if you have friends, embrace them. If you have loved ones, cherish them. If you have acquaintances, respect them. And if you have love, show them. God bless you all. Good night.
This has been a Night Talk production in association with Terra Chat Networks and BlogTalkRadio.com. Blessings on your household.